Go ahead, Barry, we're ready.
Oh, yeah. You're waiting on me.
God, we're always waiting on Barry. It's exhausting.
It's terrible. It's a terrible thing. You know, we've been here all day, and now we're waiting on you. Go.
Oh, my goodness. Welcome back. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy. This is our final session, our final module of this course. That's what it is.
Two-day course
on developing universal apps with C# and XAML. We've talked about a lot of features and things like that. We've talked a lot about approach, concept, architecture, things that we've done inside our application, our demo app that we built as well. Now we're going to talk about what else we might have done, things that we didn't show in tremendous detail inside the application.
Or things that, frankly, we just didn't get time to do.
Or things we might not have had time to do. That's exactly right. In addition to that, we're going to monitor the chat window starting now. I notice Chakotay is in the chat window. Totally brings back, I'm sure it's not a reference to Star Trek, but in my mind it always is, so that's pretty awesome. So we'll be monitoring the chat window as well. If you have a question, just do us a favor. Add Q colon before it happens. Ah!
Ah! You little guy. gets me every time.
It is so good. It's so good. All right, let's start. We've got a long list of fun things we can talk through, and that's where we're going. Other runtime features and SDKs. Talk about
a broad term.
Yeah, whatever it is. And then after that, we'll talk about advanced ideas.
Now, that isn't at all pretentious, is it?
This is going to be the hardest session, or it might be the easiest. I don't know. It'll certainly be the most interesting for you, we hope. All right. Let's start about talking about our favorite girl, Cortana.
Cortana.
Cortana introduced in Windows Phone
8.1.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this is she's our virtual assistant on Windows Phone. But what does it mean to a developer? Well, it means this right here. Hi, I'm Cortana. And what she'll do is she enables.
You're Jerry. You're not Cortana.
I know. I was reading the slide.
Oh, that's a shame. You should never read a slide.
It's just.
It's just bad presenting manners.
Yeah, I'm not a good presenter.
I know.
All right, but what does Cortana actually mean to us insofar as an API and things that we can interact with? Well, first thing to remember is phone only. Windows 10 was released today.
Oh, really?
So, that allowed us to get a little prelude. We'll just move from there. But right now, we're building applications for what we have today. I think it's worth saying the strategy for building applications on Windows 10 is to build universal apps on Windows 8.1. That's the reason we have this course, and that's the reason we're investing into this technology. It is a we are on the strategy path right now. But right now, Cortana is phone only, but what does she actually give us? The first thing she gives us is voice commands, so your application is not even running. Remember when we showed Toast notifications coming across? Toast notifications allowed us to tap it and launch our application, passing in different arguments. That's exactly how voice commands work. Before our application is even running, we can ask Cortana to do something. I don't know if you've done it. Have you ever done the Facebook integration? You could say, Facebook, what's up with Darren? That's their code, what's up with. You say, what's up with Darren? It'll launch Facebook.
And it'll say innumerable things.
It'll say, let me enumerate through that.
Let me enumerate through that enumeration.
Oh my gosh, that's what it does too.
It's really amazing.
Anyway, so that's voice commands that allows us to ask something specific of our application, get passed in, look at the arguments, figure out what just happened, and then direct the user to the right place. That's really cool for a voice operator. Another thing it gives us is speech.
Did you know that you can set up via Bluetooth in your car to actually call to Cortana? That by default, when in Windows Phone 8.1, it actually creates an entry in your contacts list for Cortana, and there's a unreachable phone number that's set up. So if you actually, in your vehicle, say, call Cortana, it will actually dial Cortana, and then you'll actually be in the speech recognition mode of Cortana.
It's brilliant. I use it all the time. I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. I love it when I'm driving along and my wife's with me, and I'm like, call Cortana. Hi, Jerry, what do you need? Hey, how far is it to this? My wife's rolling around.
Do you have your head moving like that as well when you do it?
Hey, guys. That's the way I drive. Yeah, totally.
In your Prius.
In my Prius. It's totally quiet. It's a Tesla, not a Prius. If I'm going to have an electric car, it's going to be a Tesla. Okay. All right. Speech recognition is the next thing that it gives us. It allows us to enable an interface so the user can speak directly to our application. Super duper cool. It also gives us the opposite, text to speech. And so we also have that, I believe we have that in Windows too, don't we?
There are many speech synthesis APIs that are available in Windows, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so anyway, you can go back and forth that way. It gives us a lot of fun, like, control. And here in the slide,
I was going to say, well, we already have text-to-speech was in the phone platform because you think about your navigation apps that would read directions and tell you those things.
Oh, that's right. It would, but that was I'm glad you pointed that out. That was a limited vocabulary, mm-hmm. and now you can do it with whatever magical machine learning Cortana has on the back end to be able to synthesize
up. It does require a data connection.
It does require a data connection. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm glad you told me. I didn't realize that. All right, if you're wondering, I'd like to see some code samples about how to do this. No problem. We included them here on the slide. You can go download the slides. Can they download the slides right now? Well, whenever you can download the slides, you got it.
Yeah, I think some of the resources, there's a resource tab that they can get to some of these things.
That's right. That's how it works. Another thing we could have added is geofencing. So geofencing is sort of like the location API. Geofencing means that you get to draw a circle on a map such as this. So I could draw a circle on the map, one or two. In this case, I've drawn three circles, three different geofences. As I move in or out, that's the event, the two events you get. As you move in or out of the boundary of that circle, it's only circles right now.
Mm-hmm.
As you move in and out of it, you get an event and then you get to react to it. So maybe you go into it and you wanna turn on Wi-Fi, you wanna go into it, you wanna, I don't know, send a tweet. You want to go into something and it sends off a home automation operation that turns on your lights. There's a lot of different
things. Let's talk about this in terms of a solarizer scenario.
Okay.
So the idea was that you would be navigated into the general area of where appointments were, and then as you entered that area, it would then turn around and tell you specifically when you needed to have your next appointment in that area. So, there was a lot of interesting things we could have done with that. And this is really what Cortana is using when you say, remind me when I get home to do X.
That's right. This is one of those APIs that you have both on the phone and on Windows. You can use it either way. And so when you are, that's new now in Windows 8.1. That you have it unified both across both platforms so you can use it. So it kind of just depends on how you want to do it. So anyway, this is totally converged, totally universal, and available to every developer. So thanks. Barry is terrible.
He is.
Have you noticed that?
Yes.
I'm like, it's hard to follow. All right.
Apart from the big red light that's on top of the camera. But other than that, yes, it's totally impossible to determine which one we're on.
You might be thinking, I'd really like to see some samples. Where can we get those? We've included those on the slide as well. Where are we finding all these samples? We might as well just share it. We're finding it at msdn.com.
Yeah, secret.
We've kept
the secret is out.
Secret for years. First revealed here. All right. So how to use geofencing, some things that developers should know. This is the sort of stuff that just kind of catches you at first. This is a capability that you're going to have to ask for. So this is a matter of putting it in your AppX manifest. Also defining that circle that you're going to need. You define it with a radius and a center point. It does all the rest for you. And then whatever your events are, you kind of go from there. It's up to you to take action on them. All it does is raise the events. Even if your app's not running, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool.
Yep, very much so.
Whoa, boy, this is going to be a big topic.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Brace yourself.
And Darren.
So, instrumentation and telemetry.
Instrumentation and telemetry.
What do we mean by instrumentation and telemetry?
That is a stinky thing to do.
So, instrumentation.
Oh, it's all right. Instrumentation.
I'll take pity on you. Come on.
All right, go.
So, instrumentation, telemetry. One of the key things when you're building applications is you want to be cognizant of what's going on inside your application. So we have built some basic error handling in our application, which deals with the situation when things go wrong. But if you're building any sort of application that may be addressing a specific market, you're trying to, say for example, you're building an application that is effectively a marketing application. You may be producing it for a specific brand. They want to see what sort of user engagement has been achieved in this application. And so we typically use instrumentation and the associated telemetry to identify who is logging into the application, where they're going in the application, how long they're actually engaging with the various experiences, what are the preferred experiences within the application, and so on. And equally, you know, whether people just bounce in, bounce out, and they never come back. These are kind of key pieces of information that are very useful. On top of that, it's also very useful to start to gauge how the application is performing in a real-world environment in terms of we come into the main screen, how long does it take for that rendering to have completed before we can then transition into other states and so on. So instrumentation and telemetry are effectively the capabilities that we can plug into our application to capture these key events and then to surface them up for analysis.
You know, inside Solarizer, maybe one of the things we might have done was make it so every time the application loads, that's an event that we instrument, right? And so now we store that event occurred. That gets sent up to the server so that we can analyze it later. Maybe we also have an instrumented event on every command button that we have. Mm-hmm. So every time those, which buttons are being used, which buttons aren't being used. Maybe we have instrumentation around the suspension. Maybe we have instrumentation around when we call out to the service, whether or not that works or not, mm-hmm. how much time it takes. That's what we actually want to measure instead. So we measure that and we instrument that up as well. It all gets sent up to the cloud into a giant super database. And then the telemetry is basically the reporting. That's where we get the intelligence from it, basically.
And one of the things that, you're talking about behaviors from earlier on, one of the things that we did for a previous set of projects was we actually built behaviors that introduced this telemetry instrumentation, and the front-end developers, the integrators, could actually just drag those behaviors onto all the buttons, and it would automatically do that.
Yeah. So right now, this is October 1st. I think that's important to say because there is this idea of a one Microsoft solution, different tooling that you can get for all the different aspects of your application and use that as your solution. What is the instrumentation solution for Universal Apps? On October 1st, we really don't have a fully supported implementation.
Not within the Microsoft ecosystem, absolutely.
Right.
There are other solutions that are out there that we could
leverage.
Doesn't
mean you don't have choices. That's
yep.
right. It's just that one Microsoft option isn't there yet. When it is there and when it's coming, it's just a month or so away, it's going to be Application Insights. So Application Insights, fully baked and ready to go for ASP.NET MVC sites to use this.
Mm-hmm.
But for Universal Apps, it's on the way. That's just the way that works. We kind of talked about that, how we're kind of rolling into this convergence of not just the APIs, but we're also rolling into this convergence of all the SDKs supporting Universal Applications as well.
Yeah.
What are some of the options if we step outside?
So one of the most broadly used ones in terms of the web space is Google Analytics. It's a little JavaScript option that you can drop in. It has a great sort of reporting UI. It's very easy to integrate to that from a third-party application. We use it across a large number of platforms for different capabilities. There are many others that have come along that have, to a certain extent, enhanced what you can capture through those sort of basic instrumentation APIs. Marked Up is one that is pretty popular in the space that we're working in right now.
Yep, I've used Marked Up many, many times. Yep. Pretty nice. And one nice thing about Marked Up, by the way, is it's kind of geared towards apps. Google mm-hmm. Analytics, the UI.
Or website.
It works all right, but it kind of frustrates me a little. If you look at how Marked Up works, it's almost geared towards what we're doing. It's just an easy step in. By the way, almost all of these are free up to a certain point.
Yes. Start putting them out there. Maybe one of the things that are really useful for these things is if you're going to put your app out for a beta test, then putting these analytics in, even if you've got a limited audience, really helps you understand the behaviors of those people who are using your application.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing something that may be a daily journaling, here is how you can check. Are people coming in and doing a daily journal? If they are coming in, where are they going? What are the features of your application that you're using? How many clicks is it taking for them to get to their preferred features?
Yeah.
Because you might want to change the user experience and move that
up. Once you have a million users out there, there's a lot of things you can't track anymore. You don't know if things are going right, going wrong. Your one little test that you're doing on your device or whatever
exactly.
is totally insufficient. Now,
being able to see a graph that shows all the how people are really moving through your app, where they're spending time, it's just invaluable. It really is.
For the rest of us, he means beta test. Beta test. It's hilarious. All right, similar to telemetry is logging. So this is when something goes wrong, we need to get a lot of information, right?
Yeah.
And so here something goes wrong, we need to use logging. Conveniently, this sort of diagnostics is already built into the framework for us. All of us already have it. It's fully supported inside Universal Applications. Tell us just a little bit about it.
Sure. So one of the key things about logging has been, there's always been this trade-off between how much logging you do and the impact that logging has on the performance of your application. You can switch on logging that logs every single API call. You could do that either through explicit coding or through aspect-oriented development, which is another feature we're not really going to go into. But that allows you to attach this logging to everything that goes on within the app. It can be very expensive mm-hmm. if you're doing it on every single thing. So normally what happens is you have these levels of whether it's verbose logging, whether you're only logging warnings, errors, or critical errors, and so on.
Almost like a volume knob you can turn up and down so that if everything's okay, just dial it back so you don't log too much.
Yep. And that's worked great when you've got server-connected systems and so on. It can roll up to a central log analyzer like the Windows Server Event Log and so on, or the Event Viewer, I should say. When you start moving on to a mobility solution, you have the problem that the error has occurred for somebody who's sitting in a parking lot somewhere on a mobile phone. How do you perform diagnostics and understand what's going on in their crash report? Are they going to spend a large amount of time ringing you up, telling you, hey, my application for ordering from Pizza Hut or whatever is
error
crashing.
Code 4411X234442. Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. They're just going to restart it. And that's one of the nice things about mobile is, to a certain extent, apps are almost considered to be transitory experiences anyway. And so, it crashes. Oh, I'll start it up. People are just used to that. It's not an excuse to build apps that crash, mind you. So there's been this problem of how you would do that. The great thing about event tracing for Windows that's incorporated in the platform is it's incredibly lightweight. It's an asynchronous operation in terms of capturing some of these things, and it takes microseconds to execute, unlike many of these other features that are normally written in a managed language that take a little bit longer to execute, maybe redirect and run through a whole bunch of validation before they write out to these logs. ETW is optimized. It writes into a memory buffer initially. The impact on your application is very, very light. There are a number of great options around configurability. Now, for example, you can have multiple logging channels that may be tracking various sections of your application. Mm-hmm. All of those logging channels can be part of a single logging session. In general, that writes to a circular memory buffer. So instead of worrying about creating this never-ending log file that's never going to, or it's going to fill up your storage on your phone, it's going to be constantly logged into a memory buffer, hits the end, starts at the beginning again. So you've got a snapshot in time that's constantly moving along. So if you do get a critical error, you can then just grab the buffer up to a certain point and persist that instead. We can also deal with the scenario that if a critical error occurs, we capture that log, we write it out to local storage. Then because we're in a critical error scenario, we have to allow our application to exit. So we mentioned earlier on about the app unhandled exception handler. That's a key place where you would normally put these things. The best way to exit there is not to use application.exit, because that's actually grounds for rejection in the app store, is actually just to rethrow the initiating exception, and then that will cause your application to exit anyway.
So let's be clear. We just talked about instrumentation and telemetry. That's how you look and report on what's going on inside your application. Logging is not how you do that. Mm-hmm. Logging is really meant to understand why errors are occurring. So when you were explaining the circular memory buffer, the circular memory buffer allows us to, so I'm taking almost like a performance counter, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going in and this just occurred, let's write that into the memory buffer. This just occurred, write that into the memory buffer. If nothing ever goes wrong, all of that gets thrown away. We don't log just for the sake of nothing. Mm-hmm. And then an error occurs, I want to take what's in the memory buffer because it'll tell me the last 10, 15, 20, 2, 3, I mean, whatever it is,
whatever
steps that the user did to kind of get to where you are. That gets written out to a file, that gets queued up for upload into, mm-hmm. let's say, blob storage where you can analyze it yourself.
Yeah.
This isn't a reporting system, this is a logging system.
And to speak about the upload scenario, typically you would look for the existence on this log the next time you execute. Because your application has just been shut down, mm-hmm. you're gonna wait until the next launch is there, then you're either gonna detect in the background and initiate a background transfer, or you could actually turn around and say, hey, look, it looks like an error has occurred. Do you wish to share this report and give the user an opt-in?
Right.
That may be important if you're sending a non-trivial amount of data across their data connection.
It's also important that when you're capturing things that are going on, be sensitive that there's a possibility that there is personal information inside that log, right? So you just typed a whole bunch of things. It turns out it's the password that you typed that was a problem. The reason we know is we passed that back to the logging system. Well, don't do things like that, right?
Yeah.
This isn't about violating privacy. This is about figuring out errors. And so be careful as you're keeping that log and where you're sending it and what you're doing with it as well. All right.
And at least make sure that if you are sending personal information across, that you have called out what you're doing with it in your privacy policy. That's a very key thing. So if you're turning around and saying, yes, there may be personal identifying information may be being shared with us and stored in our servers. However, it's only going to be stored for the purposes of error diagnosis. We're only going to keep it for 2 days. It's never going to be shared with an external agency and so on and so forth. So that's one of the key things. Privacy policy is a required aspect of your applications to publish in the App Store. So make sure whatever you do, it is covered in your privacy policy.
Yeah, that's a great point. That really bypasses. All right, let's talk about PDF generation. One of the things that in Solarizer could have done, I go to a different place and I check their roof or whatever it is and I create a receipt and I want to send that off to them. What's the format that I want to send that off? Let's create a PDF and send that PDF off as a receipt that I email to them. Or even more likely, maybe there's a PDF that I want to be able to read. So the new PDF API inside the runtime is totally built in so I can use PDFs, even password protected PDFs, and I can take the individual pages, render those as images that I show to the user. That's the way the PDF API works. That hits probably 90% of the use cases you would need to interact with a PDF, which is really great. And so there's some best practices around it, but let's talk about the fact this is using the ISO standards around PDF. This is not something special just for Microsoft, just a standard PDF, and it abstracts away the complexity that you would usually use to try and interact with this standard. This is definitely focused on creating it as an image, and as we said before, password protected PDFs, they're fully supported. So there are some best practices to remember, and I might point out that this is all presented by the product team that created this API at buildwindows.com. Mm-hmm. All of the build content is available at buildwindows.com. That's actually a quick redirect to Channel 9, but kind of takes you to the build part of Channel 9, no doubt. But these best practices that we go through, they're really about being able to manage memory usage to make sure you don't render out all the pages at once, but you allow them to be virtualized so you only get the pages that you want to have, and you release all of the pages that you don't need anymore. That's really what it's about, and this is really a good conversation in this context because all of a sudden we have a lot of high-end images that we're holding in memory, mm-hmm. and you have to think a little differently than probably most applications, which only have a few images that they're dealing with at one time. But you know, you download a really large PDF with 100 pages, render all of that to 100 high-definition images, all of a sudden you really have a problem that could cause your application to be terminated by the operating system because it's consuming just too much memory. But you can deal with that just with a few strategies. Great.
Sounds good.
There is this idea of background tasks. Background tasks are just in case your application needs to run whenever, just in case you have code that needs to run when your application isn't running. And so let's look just real quickly here. Let me just jump through. Whoop. There we go. Let's look at the idea of system triggers. There are two things inside background tasks that matter. The first one are conditions, and the second one are triggers. A condition for a Windows runtime background task means that the background task will never run unless first this condition is met. So for example, the user has to be logged on, right? That might be a condition that you need. The internet has to be connected. That might be a condition you need. Fine, you set those up first to make sure your background task doesn't execute whenever it wouldn't be able to work anyway. Then you have these triggers that occur. So first the condition is right. So the condition is right, the user is logged on, and we have an internet connection. Now we need something else to happen. So maybe the lock screen application gets added, or maybe the an SMS is received, the time zone is changed. Any of these triggers could be executed then. The conditions are met, and then the trigger occurs, your background task then executes, and the code that you have then runs. The only thing worth remembering is that background tasks inside the Windows runtime, they are governed, quarantined? No, there's a constraint.
Yeah, you're talking about the constraint quota. Time that they can't, the quota.
Ah, they have a quota. A quota around CPU usage, a quota around network usage, and a quota around clock time. All of those things matter, so the execution that you do, and it's actually quite small. A single CPU second is the typical quota unless you're put onto the lock screen. And so that single CPU second goes pretty quickly. Don't forget you can do asynchronous operations as long as the CPU isn't working. Maybe you're waiting on a website or a web service to return data, and that takes 2 or 3 seconds. That doesn't count against you. 1 CPU second is how long the CPU is actually working. Anyway, so that's background tasks. Mm-hmm. Another thing we could have added to Solarizer in order to do things. One of them we could have done on Solarizer, the web, on the phone, and the phone only is where this is supported right now, is the XML rendering background task. So the XML rendering background task allows me to build up
XAML.
It allows me to build some sort of XAML tree. And build out what image I want to look like for my tile. And so I want a custom tile. I'm not satisfied with the way that the templates lay it out. No big deal. I'll build my own, make it very unique and very, you know, a lot of business value or user value there. And then I'll let this background task render it and set it. Now the reality is, as great as this task is, it could take more than a single CPU second to execute. So it makes sense for us to go back a step. I say back, that's not the right word, but anyway, change lanes over to C++, not write this in C#, so we have to let the CLR come in. That just might not work in this scenario. We need to do it in C++ instead. That's because we need to execute inside our window, but we want to make sure that it gets done as well. So you can have different languages. You can use background tasks in C++, but still keep your application in C#, no problem.
Yeah, other common use would be for perhaps checking to see if there's new appointments that have been allocated to our agent while she's out on the road. You know, periodically check, see if there's anything out there, post up in a little alert or a tile notification or something like that as an alternate to pushes.
That's right. The other one that's important to know around background tasks is that there's a background transfer task. And Darren and I have kind of spoken to this several times, and the idea is this is part of the underlying operating system that handles uploads and downloads for you. It allows you to take a file like a blob or an image or something like that, queue it, and let it be sent up to a website and or pulled down from a website even when your application isn't running. And the operating system handles the entire thing, managing the data transfer, stopping, pausing, waiting until you have Wi-Fi connection, whatever it is that the user needs for their device, obeying their commands and things like that. So the background transfer task is pretty great, and it supports FTP, whatever it is you need. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've seen questions coming through every now and again about how do we use web API for transferring very large files? Well, the answer really is, especially on the phone, that you shouldn't be trying to do that interactively as part of your application. That's yes, you can do it. Yes, you can tweak timeouts and so on and so forth, but I would certainly recommend if you're trying to move large files around that you actually break that file up into chunks yourself and don't try and stream it across on a single connection. The reality is that's exactly why these background transfer tasks exist. They are robust. They allow you to queue jobs up. They will automatically detect whether you want to send the data across on your data plan or whether you're going to wait if you're Wi-Fi connected. They're basically how the store apps work. You know, you might be able to upgrade small apps on a data plan, but it may wait for a very large game, for example, that has a lot of content. It'll wait until you're Wi-Fi connected before it'll download that game from the store and so on. So think about the scenario. Think about how you're using it, how much data you're transferring across. If it's possible to defer and continue in your application and wait for that to finish either whilst you're running or on an offline scenario, try and make sure you use the background transfer task.
Darren, we just graduated. We just went from things we could have done to advanced ideas. Right? Mm-hmm. An arbitrary title we gave to some more ideas to talk about.
Because we wanted to put a section break in there to make it easy for
Barry. We'll kind of blast through these, though. These we kind of put as bullet points rather than entire slides so we can go quickly. The first one is this idea of SignalR. This is a technology inside Microsoft that allows different applications to talk almost in real time by using a broker on the server. So mm-hmm. I open up what is effectively a web socket, but it can use other technologies depending on what's supported, to talk to my web server and to broadcast information, kind of like a push notification, to any of the active clients that are also connected. And so SignalR is pretty awesome and potentially an alternative to push notifications, partly because it'll be faster. Mm-hmm. And it's more like a raw push notification in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's as you mentioned, it's faster and can well be used for two-way communications as well.
That is weird. Look at the E on dispatcher. Doesn't that seem like it's really thick? That's really crazy looking.
That's because there's a strike through on it.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. All right, good.
It's because dispatcher isn't spelt with an ER, is it?
Dispatch. Is that right?
Yeah.
The other would be advanced multi-tenancy. And so we didn't really talk about this at all. We did say that, you know, there might be a case here, there might be a case there where you need to separate your data, either for practical reasons because your customers don't want to be intermingled, or maybe because you're internally you have legal reasons to separate your data, or you might even have ethical reasons to separate your data as well, right? That's a reality.
Yep.
All right, that's the idea of multi-tenancy. You can handle that by copying your application all the way, or you can start partitioning it internally and do a logical separation as well. We did talk about provisioning, the idea of pulling down data that we've pre-prepared, mm-hmm. and the idea of backing up a database, making a copy of it, and then queuing that so it's using the background task to upload that up to maybe blob storage or somewhere where it can either be extracted, stored, or whatever it is that we need. So we did kind of cover that, and I'm glad that we did. More along the ideas of advanced ideas that you can think of inside your app that we could have done, right? One of them is the idea of Xamarin view models. So it's not Xamarin view models, Xamarin PCLs, mm-hmm. portable class libraries.
Yep.
These are PCLs that are written inside a special set of constraints that allow them to be built specifically for Windows, but they can also be built for iOS. They can also be built for Android. The whole time the developer gets a C-sharp experience.
Yep. Yeah, and really what you're trying to talk about there is that PCL would contain things like the view models, model definitions, maybe service definitions, and so on and so forth. But it's highly likely in this cross-platform scenario that you're going to have custom views. Certainly on the Xamarin platform today, you know, you're going to be using the Xamarin Forms to build a UI as an example.
Yep.
But there's no reason why you couldn't reuse the capabilities that we built into our vModel.
Another option might be Cordova. So you could use Cordova and the new tooling in Visual Studio for Cordova to build HTML apps that go across platform as well. So we didn't do this, of course, but other ideas would be cross-platform way of kind of approaching this. Some UI considerations we almost did for the app was a unified top navigation bar that would allow us to navigate through it. Turns out with just two pages, a top navigation bar seemed like it was a little bit overkill. We almost did it anyway, and probably the best way to do it, well, there are two approaches. One is you could have a page on top of a page. Mm-hmm. And then the base page that you have never navigates away. It just holds I said page on top of a page. You could have a frame on top of a frame, and the base frame is the one that can overlay the top navigation bar, and then that internal frame is where all the page navigation occurs. You're gonna have to update the way the navigation works to make mm-hmm. sure this works properly,
yep.
but it doesn't mean you can't do it that way, and it works just fine.
Yes.
It'll work just fine. The second way you could do it is with a user control shared across. In a way, we kind of did that mm-hmm. with the header user control that we put on both pages.
Yep.
That's where you could have that unique look at a top nav bar or something like that, which is totally inappropriate on the phone.
Totally.
Totally inappropriate.
Not enough space.
Keyboard navigation is another option. This is worth thinking about. How are we going to move around through your application with the left, right, up, down keys? Is going to be very important, especially in context of accessibility. We didn't talk almost anything about third-party controls and charting, like Infragistics or Component One or Telerik. There's a lot of great control suites out there. We didn't use any of those, but it's worth whatever one you pick to evaluate those, both for performance, both for whether or not they support what you're trying to do and the design patterns that you have, but also, you know, their accessibility is important, the ability to theme them so they match all the other controls that you have, and how much they cost probably matters, but we didn't use them, so we didn't have to think about that.
Yep.
We didn't implement the print contract. That would only be for Windows.
It's a challenging contract to implement. We certainly covered that in the, I think it was in the advanced.
I hope it was.
Yeah. Yeah, the print contract is a challenging contract in terms of actually just generating for print is difficult because you need to be able to measure what it is you're putting onto the page if you're going to be printing out multiple page documentation. So we covered it, I was going to say ad nauseum, but the reality was we were really only able to scratch the surface in about 40, 45 minutes and actually put together a basic implementation that showed you how you would paginate and so on and so forth.
Something else that we didn't do but could have done was the ability to present on a second screen. So even though I'm in a window, it doesn't mean I can't write an application that launches another window and then maintains communication between the two of those. So that's really great. I guess on one page or one screen, I could have both. But the real problem use case is multiple screens. Or think of it like a point of sale solution where I'm interacting with my register and then I have a second screen that's facing the customer. That's another possible use. Solarizer really didn't have that, so we didn't really jump on it, but it's another option we could have sort of jumped towards. Another one is a brand new library that was just released for Windows Runtime. The OCR library allows us to bring in images and then extract the text from those images. It's no longer service-based like it used to be. Now it's all client-side. It handles multiple languages. Pretty cool library, very efficient as well. One thing we could have done, and this actually would have been pretty cool, is the ability to do handwriting.
Yep.
But we know we have limitations around, let's say, inking.
Yes.
Inking's not supported on the phone. It's only supported on Windows. So whatever solution we would have had to have come up with would have needed to be supported on both. It's not that big of a deal to use a dynamic path inside XAML. So we could have handled it as ink on one, dynamic path on the other, or maybe just on both. It's just a signature. If UPS is any guide, signature and get away with it.
Certainly the worst one, yes.
Yeah, totally. Then there is the, we didn't do this, but this is just another advanced idea that for you to be able to know is in your toolkit, and it's the idea of using the XAML reader. The XAML reader receives a string of XAML that you create dynamically. It then renders that as actual UI that you can use. There were a lot of base, I think the early Bing search app did this, where the server generated what it looked like, and then it rendered it up whatever it was. And so that gives you almost infinite flexibility to be able to keep your application very, very flexible the way it looks. But there's certainly a performance impact. You better really need this before you go that route. But know that it's in your toolbox if you do, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Here's a great one. Don't miss this list of additional toolkits. So we were basically talking about features inside the runtime, a few of the libraries. These are our third-party library directory. So there are definitely some on CodePlex and GitHub out there that are also available, but these are the professional ones, and you can get to it at DevCenter, partners.windows.com/directory. It's a long, silly URL, but there it is anyway.
It's like an aka.ms.
There's probably about 12 or 14 there, and it kind of varies depending on when you're looking at it as well. All right, module recap. We talked about Cortana. We talked about geofencing, instrumentation, logging, PDF rendering, background tasks, advanced ideas. That's the entire module. I wanted to kind of jump through it. I'm talking a little quicker now because I want to see if we have some ability to chat and talk with the chat room as well, as we talked about before. See if there are any questions that we can answer. Super thank you going out to Nick. Super thank you going out to Sean. Super thank you going out to Paul as well. All of you guys handling questions the way you were was really great. Super thank you for Chris. Still sleeping.
Yeah.
That's great. And
okay, what do we have?
Let's see what we have.
I see a question from James P. If you have already created an app with string literals built into the XAML, What is the easiest way to extract them from the code into a resource file? Are there any tools that you recommend to quickly accomplish the task?
No.
No? Mark one eyeballs and fingers, unfortunately.
Yeah, that would be a pretty cool tool.
I mean, I guess in reality, if we think about it, XAML is well-formed XML. And so you could, in theory, identify the attributes that you're looking for on the elements and do something that could harvest. But I would say it's probably, unless you've got a very substantial application, it's probably going to take longer to build something like that. And you'd obviously have to have a justification to run it multiple times before it'd be worthwhile investing in that.
Yep. Nick's helping me out here. Steve and Dave, I could also give a quick call out for the help that they gave us today as well. I was thinking while you were saying that, by the way, that we can easily do a find using regular expressions inside Visual Studio.
Yep.
So it would at least help you find, I suppose.
But it's not going to migrate it into it at all.
Nah, there's no migration.
Yes. Yeah.
That'd be a killer tool.
It would be. There you go. There's your opportunity, James P. Write that and share it with the community.
Did you know that we have a poll on this course? We totally do, and hopefully you've already seen it and participated. If you haven't, then jump on the poll and vote now so we can get all of your answers tallied and coordinated like that. All right, let's keep going. Please put a Q colon if you have a question.
So I see a question from Klaus H. It doesn't have a Q, but we'll give this one a shot anyway. Does the resource system inherit from the base language, for example, uses English, if the Danish entries are missing one or more of the strings? So if there's it should fall back if it's unable to resolve it, but there's a good question about whether if there's a missing resource. So I certainly know in the web, and we built a multilingual web application that in the circumstances where we had an Italian translation and it was incomplete, it certainly did fall back to using values from the English resource. So I believe it does load in the English resource dictionary or whatever the default language dictionary is for your environment, the development environment, and then supersede that with locales. But I couldn't answer that empirically in this scenario.
I don't think I could either. I would like to know the answer. Figure out that answer for us and send it to me. jnixon@microsoft.com. I'd be really curious to know it. Or just tweet it so everybody can see it at Jerry Nixon.
So Andre Abrantes asks a question about comparing MVVM Lite and Prism. So this is one of those things in which it's tomatoes to a certain extent. You know, they both provide solutions for the same problems. Prism provides solutions in certain areas that aren't addressed by MVVM Lite. MVVM Lite has other solutions in other areas that aren't covered or incorporated within the Prism framework. Mainly, I would turn around and say, yeah, whatever you're most familiar with, carry on using, because they both do a great job in terms of solving the problems that they set out to address.
I agree. There you go. The XAML background, the XAML rendering background task, is it only in C++? And the answer is totally no. You can do it however you want because it's a Windows runtime component. It's already projected into every language. But the reality is you don't want to do it in C#. It's the odds of you being able to execute and do everything inside the runtime and run it on a low-end phone at the same time, the odds are just against you for it working. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, what else we got?
Quite a few more questions yesterday.
Okay, question from Daytona Rob. Do you know if it's possible in a universal app to use NFC to read RFID badges? I'm thinking a delivery app, a delivery app that can accept an RFID badge signature. I do not know. Now, I do know that there is capabilities included from Windows Phone 8.1 onwards that deal with Bluetooth LE, yes, low energy, and I believe that there is a significant overlap in the radio protocols that are covered in there. So it's a maybe. I don't know is the honest answer, but I believe that there is a lot of capability that's been built into that wireless stack to allow you to deal with a number of these scenarios.
Mm-hmm. The one thing you can know is that you can extend it to any custom device that has a USB driver. And so that's also a new feature in Windows 8.1 that allows you to use the native USB driver to use custom things that you plug in, including a reader. So that's a possibility as well. Totally a possibility.
Okay, a question from Mike D1215. Question, sorry that this question comes late in the course. Would the multiple screen scenario be a good example of when messaging might be a great way for inter-app communications? I've heard that this is one way to handle messaging.
Yes, of course.
Seems like a great idea to us.
Yeah, yeah. You definitely don't want the two to have a like direct connection to each other.
Yep.
Then you fall into the same problem that messaging is saving the whole time.
Okay, question from Brian OFLD. How have you handled and continue methods that Phone 8.1 introduced, where Store Apps is using the async version without using the Continuation Manager CS added to a new solution? So the Continuation Manager CS is just an implementation of how to deal with this. We're obviously leveraging some of the capabilities inside Prism to deal with that. So if you actually look in the app.xaml.cs of Solarizer, you will see exactly how we're dealing with the and continues for the web authentication broker and for file picker.
Yeah. Andrew asked if Cortana works over Wi-Fi or if it just works over data. It definitely works over Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. All you need is a connection of any kind.
Yeah, it'll fall back to data if Wi-Fi is unavailable.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, either way we look at it, this is the time that we're needing to end. Anything you want to just pontificate here at the very last second?
No, I've had 2 days of that platform.
Boy, that is the truth, isn't it? All right, building universal apps is not, this course is not the one that teaches you XAML. If you're looking for courses that teach you XAML, there are two others. They're the essentials and the advanced of building Windows Store apps with XAML. Go watch those and get familiar with the basics. Then come back here and see some of the advanced things that you can do, as well as some, think about some of the design implications, as well as some of the architectural concepts that we went through. Go to xaml.codeplex.com, download the source code that we put together, be able to see all the implementations that we talked about and see that they can really be done in an application that works. Also, consider an MVVM framework like Prism. Prism is great, super lightweight, and enables you to have all the MVVM stuff that you want. It totally supports pub sub events, totally supports Unity as well. And why not? Because it's written specifically for Windows Store apps, and it solves a lot of problems for you quickly and very, very easily as well. Don't look past Azure. Azure allows us to store information up there, both with SQL and table, but also through blob storage that we demonstrate here in Solarizer. And also secure your application as well as your service. It's not outside of your realm, that's for sure. We've written the wrapper for you that you can look. You can extend it to be whatever it is you want, or just use it right out of the box. That's Active Directory in Azure. You get it for free anyway. Why wouldn't you use it? And if you want to, you can extend it or expand it out of your on-premise Active Directory out into the cloud, so you can have roaming field applications that you know are also secure as well, and you can disable a user internally and he's disabled in the field as well. That's exactly what you want to be able to do. Sound right to you?
Sounds great to me.
Thanks for being with us today. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy, developing universal window apps with C# and XAML. I'm Jerry, this is Darren.
And the monkey says goodbye.
Have a great day.
Bye.